So I've described these two pictures of culture the internet's producing, read only, read write. Let's think about some important differences between them. First difference we might focus on is the values embedded in each of these two cultures. Read-write culture is leading us to leave behind this picture of what our culture is like, the couch potato image. No longer passive, our children are actively engaged in the creative process using these technologies to express. And you could look at this and then celebrate what we might call lefty ideals like democratic or social or educational values. Now, all that's a little bit too Berkeley for me. I'm from Stanford. That's not really the part I want you to focus on. I want you to focus on the extraordinarily important value of money built into this read-write internet. Because if you think about this as the map of the internet, then the difference between the read-only and read-write internet is that the read-write internet will be massively more valuable to economic growth around the world. Thinking about the computers and the bandwidth and the devices and the software necessary to make this internet sing, there's a huge potential for economic growth. That's one important value of the read-write culture. But there's a second difference between the read-write internet and the read-only internet. That second difference is the attitude that the law, namely copyright law, brings to these two different kinds of cultures. For copyright law loves the read-only culture. It supports it. It supports the legal claim of the owners of read-only culture to control how people consume and use their culture. It supports the legal claim to perfect control over this culture. And importantly, we should remember copyright law hasn't always granted owners of this culture this level of control. In the old world, in the analog world, copyright regulation is actually quite limited and incomplete. Think about the uses of culture by ordinary consumers. Most of the important uses are just beyond the control of the law. Think about books in real space. If these are the uses of books, an important set of these uses are technically unregulated by the law. So to read a book is not a fair use of the book, it's a free use of the book, because to read a book does not produce a copy. To give someone a book is not a fair use of the book, it's a free use of the book. Giving someone a book does not produce a copy. To sell a book is explicitly exempted from the control of copyright law because selling a book doesn't produce a copy. To sleep on a book is an unregulated use of the book because sleeping on a book produces no copy. All of these uses are then balanced with a core set of uses that are regulated and properly regulated by the law of copyright, properly regulated because these uses are necessarily regulated to create the incentives authors need to create great new work. So you want to publish a book, you need permission of the copyright owner because that use conflicts with the necessary control to create incentives to create. And then in the American tradition, there's a thin sliver of exceptions that we call fair uses. Uses that otherwise would be regulated by the law, but which the law says ought to remain free. So for example, take my most recent book, Free Culture. You can write a review of that book, a totally idiotic review of that book. I guarantee that's possible. I've read many of those reviews. And even though you're quoting my words, copying my words, for the purpose of destroying me or criticizing me or expanding your own reputation, there's nothing I can do to control your copying of my words, even though I have a copyright on my work, because that use the law deems ought to remain free, because any free culture needs that capacity to critique and change what went before. So the point is, in the old world, most of these uses of culture that consumers engaged were free of the regulation of copyright law. And copyright law's focus was on what we would think of as commercial uses of creative work. Thus, in the old world, you couldn't legally exercise perfect control over how people consumed culture. The digital world is radically different. This is a difference produced in part by the law, but more importantly produced by the difference in the architecture of analog and digital culture. Because if copyright regulates at its core something called, quote, copies, in the digital world, what you know is that every single use of creative work produces a copy. And thus the law presumptively says every single use requires permission, so we go from this balance to this imbalance merely because the platform through which we get access to our culture has changed. And so permission is required by the law, and that permission is then supplemented by a technology to exercise physical control over the use of culture. That's the technology of digital rights management. So that together, in this read-only internet, we can increasingly perfect the control the copyright owner has over the use of culture. That is control, grounded in the law and supplemented by technology. In that sense, the law embraces the read-only internet. The law's relationship to the read-write internet is radically different. Copyright law presumptively conflicts with the read-write internet. It conflicts because in a world where every single use is a copy, then every single use requires regulation. Permission is required presumptively for everything, and permission is not coming. So AMV sites increasingly getting notice and takedowns for their creative work. This guy knew that the Beatles never authorized remixes of their work. This kid discovered when he could wow Khan for only $218, it would still take over $400,000 to clear the rights to the music in the background of the video that he shot. And this is my favorite example of insanity. I want to know how just how crazy we lawyers can be. I don't care what you think about Tony Blair. I don't care what you think about George Bush. I don't care what you think about the war. The one thing you can't say about that clip is what the lawyers said when they were asked for permission to synchronize that Lionel Richie track with those images. The lawyers said, no, you may not have permission because, quote, it's not funny, end quote. So the law, as currently architected, smothers this read-write creativity. Now, you stand back and you say, wow, two forms of culture, wildly valuable to support read-write culture. Why is there this difference in the attitude of the law? And there's a familiar view here that supports this difference. That view is that control over culture is necessary. That it's, quote, impossible to imagine the rich and vibrant culture that we have without perfect control over how culture gets consumed. There's a war, after all, the copyright wars. Wars being waged against something called, quote, piracy wars, which my friend Jack Valenti refers to as his own, quote, terrorist war, where apparently it's our children who are the terrorists in this war. This mentality of war drives this idea that we need to build locks to protect the read-only culture, digital rights management locks, even if those locks will lock out the potential of the read-write culture. Now, you have demonstrated that at the application layer, we can have freedom, coexisting, maybe dominating, proprietary control. In the content layer, we're not quite there yet. We're not quite at the place where the proprietary and the free coexist effectively and securely under the law. And to get to that place, there are steps that we need to take to support the opportunity of free culture, to make it possible. For in an important sense, the fight for free culture is harder than the fight for free software. There were no laws against free software. But there are laws that essentially block the opportunity for free culture. So we need to begin to think about the steps that will be necessary to create the opportunity for this freedom to flourish as effectively as free software has flourished. And in my view, those steps right now must be private. We can't turn to the government for this now because the government simply doesn't get it. Both political parties have been captured by Hollywood, and Hollywood's view is that the read-only culture is the only important culture for the law to support. So private steps are necessary to bring along the attitudes of many in this world till the politicians begin to get it. And I suggest three important steps here. First important step is that people like me say again and again that what we are defending is not something called, quote, piracy. If I thought this battle was a battle over your right to get access to Britney Spears' music for free, I'd be on the other side because I don't think you should get access to Britney Spears' music at any price. The question here is not free as in free beer culture. The question is the freedom that you know and you have been living for the past decade. It is the freedom to build and to spread our culture, now spread to all who have access to digital technology. So this is not piracy. This is the capacity to create and to share that creativity. So first, we must distinguish this from piracy. And second, we need to practice it, to encourage people to build and to share this kind of creative work. So more and more people say, you know, this is a lot better than watching the latest sitcom on CBS. It's more interesting. It's more critical. It's not as afraid of what the advertisers will say. It's a more important part of culture. It doesn't have to displace the others, but it can complement. But it's the third step that's most important to you and the reason why I wanted to speak to you today. The third step is to help us enable this free culture. Help us build this free platform to make it possible for this free culture to flourish. Now, that platform has two components. One is the legal component. The other is a technical component. It's the legal component that I've been working on in the project that I lead called the Creative Commons Project, whose objective, stealing the ideas of Richard Stallman from 1984, is to build a simple way for authors, importantly authors, to mark their content with the freedoms they intend their content to carry, so that the default of all rights reserved is modified to a some rights reserved default, where the freedoms that are not reserved are clearly understood. You get this license through a process of selecting, answering simple questions, a license that comes in three separate layers. One layer is a human-readable commons deed designed to be understood by anybody expressing the freedoms associated with this content. Second is a lawyer-readable license, very different billion-page document that makes enforceable the freedoms associated with the content. And third, in my view, most important here, is a machine-readable expression of the freedoms associated with the content so that search engines can begin to gather content on the basis of the freedoms. And last year, both Yahoo and Google announced search portals through which you could filter the web on Creative Commons licenses. Show me all the pictures of the Empire State Building available for non-commercial use, and the engine gathers content according to those freedoms. Now, we launched this project here in San Francisco in December of 2002, but immediately the project caught on internationally. And so we extended the middle layer, the legal code, by porting it into jurisdictions around the world, just as you would port a program from the GNU Linux operating system to Macintosh operating system. Now there are more than 70 countries in the process of this porting. Here's a map of the free world as it exists today. The green countries have already launched Creative Commons licenses. Yellow countries will launch in the next 6 months, and the red countries are yet to be liberated in this process. And as we've spread this project internationally, the growth of the uptake of these licenses has increased. 1 year after we launched, there were about 1 million link backs to our licenses. A year and a half, that number is at about 1.8 million. At 2 years, the number is at 4 million. At 2.5 years, the number is at 12 million. At 3 years, which was last December, the number is at 45 million. And then in June, the number of linkbacks to our licenses had exploded from 45 million to 140 million linkbacks to the licenses, as people around the world embrace this as a way to express the freedom free culture needs. That's the legal work. But in addition, there's technical work that I believe ultimately will be more important to this movement than the legal code that underlies it. Because free software is necessary here to support this free culture. I'm not someone who believes that there's a moral imperative never to use proprietary software. But I do believe we all have an imperative, a moral imperative, to build free software into the environment so that free culture can grow on top of it. So projects like the Ganache project to build a free Flash player, or the Og and the Vorbis project to build infrastructure around media that is free, or the project that's being hosted at Creative Commons CC Host, which enables the coordinated communities of free culture development. Here's one particular example, project we called CC Mixter, where people are invited to submit content, and then you can watch as that content is remixed. So Wired released a Wired CD with 16 tracks of artists, including the Beastie Boys, Chuck D, David Byrne, La Tigra, Gilberto Gil, a whole bunch of people, who explicitly invited people to remix their content. So here's a Beastie Boys track that's within that. And the Beastie Boys track, as you see, has been used in other remixes. So here's a remix that used the Beastie Boys track. And this track then is remixed by others too. So the point is, you begin to see the community of people. We're engaged in the practice of remixing other people's content, and to be great within this community is to produce content that's valuable to others within the community. This is GPL software. Anybody can take and adapt to whatever purpose, whether it's music or video or any purpose at all, to instill this idea of creativity growing out of this creative community process. Now, these technologies, in my view, will weaken the very strong pressure that now exists in the software layer supporting culture towards proprietary infrastructure and proprietary standards. Standards that make it extremely difficult to take video and move it across a range of different applications and use it and manipulate it. Barriers that make no sense of the ultimate objective of what free culture should be supporting.